My name's Tony Gosling. I was brought up in southeast London, went to grammar school, and then kind of studied mostly at A-levels, did physics, maths, that sort of thing, sciences. But then discovered in my year off before I went to do a degree that I was actually much more interested in the arts. And that wasn't an easy thing to do, going to university, having done sciences, to then get to go and do an arts degree.
Yeah.
But I got into a place up in Yorkshire to do a degree in humanities, which was a whole sort of spread of stuff, mainly English literature, including history, music, all sorts of other kind of arts, and had a great time doing that, really. Well away from London, it was very different to London. The people in Yorkshire were completely different. I mean, I always described it as, well, in London, sometimes when, you know, you talk to someone at a bus stop, they think you're crazy. In Yorkshire, if you didn't, they think you're crazy.
Yeah.
A completely different attitude, and much, much more well-socialised society. London was extremely competitive, and there seemed to be a kind of cooperative spirit abroad in Yorkshire. I've been back up there recently, and it really is appalling to see the way that the towns in West Yorkshire, where I was, around Keighley and places like that, are so run down. I mean, literally, nobody caring for the buildings, lots and lots of empty shops. It seems like very little work around, very badly maintained area.
It's probably quite indicative of the north, to be quite honest with you.
Generally, well, I mean, what's happened, of course, is you've got places which were built for industry, and that industry's gone.
Mm.
So these places, towns, cities, are kind of looking for something to do. They haven't got any purpose to be there anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. We've lost, obviously.
After that, I got interested in... I got into aviation. I was working in a family business, which was a aircraft business, and this is back in the days in the 1980s when Britain was still making aeroplanes. And then I got kind of bored with all that and wanted to do journalism, because that was what really got me in. The idea really is that you want something which is going to be a challenge every day. You're not going to get into ruts and routines. Every new day is a new education. And I know it's been a great privilege doing journalism, because you get to talk to such really fascinating people. And you also get the time to apply yourself to the conundrum which ordinary folk out there don't have the time to look into. So that's what I've been doing really ever since, on and off, although I did a stint in the 1990s doing land rights campaigning. And to a certain extent, I suppose I'm still doing that, because I work with the squatting group here in Bristol as an ex-squatter,
right?
Legal support for them. So I think the thing is, it's all about time, really. We don't have the time to look into stuff deeply enough, and the mainstream media, the BBC, ITV, Channel 4, Sky, and the major national newspapers know that. We don't have the time to double check what they're telling us. I think one of the most fascinating recent examples of that is the JFK files release in the US.
Yeah.
Most newspapers covered something to do with it, gave a report, but I've only seen one, and that was the Daily Mirror, that mentioned the guy that really killed Kennedy, and that's a bloke called James Files. Now, if you take a couple of days of trawling around online and ordering up and buying books to find out about the Kennedy assassination, you would eventually most certainly come to the conclusion that the whole thing was an inside job, with the FBI involved, the CIA involved, and Lyndon Johnson, the vice president, involved,
right,
to get rid of Kennedy, because they wanted to pursue the Vietnam War, and he did not.
Yeah.
And there were all sorts of other geostrategic and geopolitical things that Kennedy didn't want to do. He wanted to turn America back from a warmongering nation into a moral nation. There were very, very powerful forces, including former Nazis around, who were brought into America, former SS officers that were brought into America. They didn't want that to happen. It's interesting to see that so much of the nonsense which was talked about around that, it's just disinformation. What the mainstream press is doing on these really important issues, like the assassination of a US president, is simply diverting people in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and of course, absolutely.
Themselves understand that, I'm not sure.
Mm.
But certainly, for anyone that's got the time to look into it, you can see that there has been a a kind of Nazi continuity network going on, which was funded from the missing goal after the Second World War and all the funds.
Well, we'll get on to that in a sec. I just want to sort of build up to that that point, actually. And obviously...
Well, then I worked for the BBC for a while, which was an interesting experience. And I worked at Greater London Radio, which was one of the biggest radio stations in the country that wasn't actually a national station. In fact, it probably was the biggest. We had an enormous audience of the whole of London, millions of people. And, you know, what we used to do is amazing things would happen. Like, I remember we got a phone call, which we put through to air, on one of the phone-ins, which was about a guy who had, it was one Christmas, probably 1990 or 89 that Christmas or 91, where he'd lost, his car had been stolen with loads of Christmas presents in it. So we thought, oh, let's put this out on the radio. It just so happened that the guy who'd stolen his car was listening to GLR at the time and phoned us within about 5 minutes. We got a phone call from this guy saying it's me that stole the car. And, by the way, it's parked around the back of a tower block in such and such a place and you'll find all the presents in the back. And, we then got a phone call about an hour and a half later from the guy saying, thank you very much, Greater London Radio. Wow. For finding my car where the police could. So we were able to do things like that. I do see the media as a sort of the nervous system of humanity, and it is absolutely crucial that the people who are controlling and pulling the levers and strings at the mainstream press, particularly in broadcasting, are the sorts of people that you would be comfortable with in your kitchen or your living room, in your living space. And my experiences of having worked in mainstream press is that it's gone from a situation where most of the people who are working, their producers, managers, editors, reporters, etc., were actually quite personable types to what I describe now as a bunch of creeps.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, for example, Ian Katz, who's the editor of Newsnight. Just does not compare as a person to Sian Kevill, who in the late 1990s was editing Newsnight. Completely different people. Sian's there to present both sides of the argument. She was a proper journalist. Ian Katz is a propagandist.
Yeah.
He just left Newsnight, by the way, just the other day to take over as director of programs at Channel 4. But it's quite clear to me what's going on, both with the political parties and with the mainstream press, particularly the press.
It's the highest bidder, isn't it?
We are getting a whole bunch of agents put in place in order to steer these organizations in particular directions. We're not getting journalism. The way you can tell that you're not getting journalism is when you only get one side of the story.
Exactly. And I think to be fair to the British public or the public, the Western public, certainly the advent of the internet has certainly allowed people to become a little bit more aware of the sort of cloak and dagger behavior of the press.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, as the you become aware on the internet, so the internet becomes aware of you, and you are then tracked. Mm-hmm. And you know your date, the things that you start typing into Google. I mean, the way Google works is actually the very, very same way as Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist, described in the 1980s the surveillance by Men with Hill and the National Security Agency in Britain. I mean, he was the first person to really reveal what GCHQ and the American Secret Service were up to in their surveillance. And so this is real-time surveillance of all the phone calls in the country. Now, when we went over to digital exchanges, what that allowed, I mean, the old-fashioned manual exchange where you used to, in the old days, pick up a phone and it would go clickety-click. You know, that was a very, people who are probably over about 40 will remember that. And those old exchanges were fine. But now with the digital exchange, you've got the ability to listen in real time to every single phone call that's going on, including this Skype call that we're doing, you know, right now. I have Skype, but what they could do with that was they had voice recognition software and also, the sort of, to turn it into characters so that any conversation that included any keywords, and this is what became known as the Echelon program, which was revealed by Nicky Hager in New Zealand for the first time in the 1990s. Now, he's another brilliant investigative journalist and very much along the lines
of... What was his name again? Sorry, give us his name
again. Nicky Hager, H-A-G-E-R, pronounced like lager. And what he was revealing with that was that the way it was all set up was the entire British phone network was linked in real time to computers in the US, which would be listening to everything everyone was saying all the time. And if a particular word was, it would be able to switch it through to the National Security Agency headquarters and over in the US, and there would be someone would be able to live listen to you from their desktop monitor. So they would be able to kind of switch in, all right, here's the person, we're listening to the call now. So that would flag up certain conversations into the National Security Agency headquarters. Now, Google just works exactly the same. Mm. So as you type a search term into Google, what it does is it flags it up potentially to the National Security Agency or GCHQ, and I would imagine it's probably the NSA since Google is based in the US and it was set up by the CIA in the first place. And they can then say, well, if someone's searching for this, sir, you know, and that may be a terrorist or it may be an activist. But what we've seen with this massive surveillance state is that all of the rules post World War II that stopped there to stop secret services like the Gestapo and their friends growing up have been ripped up, because you've got no guarantees and no proper checks that the National Security Agency is not able to listen to politicians, people running political parties, lawyers, barristers, journalists, editors. In fact, anybody that is part of the building blocks of democracy is now up for grabs with this all-encompassing surveillance system.
Kind of begs the question, why there's all these terror attacks allowed to take place if they've got this surveillance?
What I would say in answer to that is that none of these terrorists use the internet.
Well, they use mobile phones. That's been proven.
Maybe not. No, maybe they don't. Maybe they just never use a mobile phone. Maybe they just go and have a chat in a cafe. I mean, any terrorist with any kind of common sense, we will know that you don't use any kind of electronic device which might be listening to what you're saying. So they won't be using phones. I mean, you know, this is just basic stuff. In Afghanistan, for example, the Taliban were known to have used very unsophisticated IEDs. So they would buy a remote control car for kids, and then they would use the actuator for that to blow up an IED. And all of the American technology that was around to try and detect these sorts of things just didn't work on these remote control car devices. So what they do is they just use different systems. And I mean, there's the evidence is points very much towards many of these terrorist attacks being about enhancing the budgets of EFBI, enhancing the budget of MI5, so that they love this kind of thing. MI5 love terrorist attacks because it just justifies their own existence even more, and then more money is channeled towards them. So I think that's where we are now with both the FBI in Las Vegas, and with MI5 in all the terrorist attacks between last Christmas and the general election, that is to say the Westminster Bridge, the Manchester attack and the London Bridge attack, all of the key people involved in those attacks were very well known to MI5.
Yeah.
Did absolutely nothing to stop them. So I think effectively we're dealing with a tyranny with MI5, that they are just simply trying to drum up bigger budgets for themselves by allowing these attacks to happen. The same exact thing happened in the IRA bombings, because MI5 were following the people that, for example, were involved in one of the big bomb attacks in London. I think it was the Baltic Exchange attack. And the IRA were waving at the security cameras. The idea was, they're not there to stop these attacks. Mm. They're there to allow them to happen and then say, well, you need to double our budget.
Right. Well, listen,
there's no scrutiny of these people. There is absolutely no oversight, no democratic oversight whatsoever of any kind of real meaning.
Right. And I guess it's that sort of level of information you've just given me there. And you've obviously got a very, you're very, very skilled speaker. So that's why I wanted to get in touch with you about the Nazis were never defeated. Following watching that, it sparked my imagination straight away.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to look at the whole Second World War. In fact, what I've seen it is a bit of a Russian doll, really. You look at it and you think, God, this guy Hitler, wasn't he crazy? And then you realise that actually there were forces that helped him. Who were those forces? Well, one of the main powers was Switzerland. And of course, just before that, Switzerland had been involved with Vladimir Lenin and was putting him in charge of Russia. So they sent Lenin from Switzerland to take over Russia and to bring about the Russian Revolution.
Ah, okay.
Right. So the Swiss Bank, the Bank for International Settlements, was created at the end of the First World War in order to administer the reparations for the war. But it ended up being providing all the foreign exchange for Hitler, providing him with a lot of money to do rebuilding and that sort of thing, and rearming. And so the Swiss, I think, and are still involved now. I mean, there's a chap called Scott Bennett who was investigating terrorist financing before he was jailed over in the US for getting rather too close to the truth to show that the Saudi Arabians and the CIA were channeling money through Switzerland to ISIS. And sort of thing, I think, is fascinating to see how these patterns are echoed. But the main thing I've discovered, I think, about World War II was that you've got a group of people in the UK who seem to have been working behind the scenes with some of the top Nazis right the way from before, even before the war.
Yeah.
So they maybe even saw it as some kind of money-making exercise, which they would win the war and then they would be able to take a cut of the money. I mean, it does sound a cynical thing. I don't think Hitler just grew up on by accident. He definitely had help, definitely from the Swiss. And the other thing was that there were these two characters that followed Hitler right the way through from the early 1930s right to the very end. One was Heinrich Müller, who was the head of the Gestapo, and the other one is this guy Martin Bormann, who ended up being the Reichskanzler, in other words, the head of the Nazi Party. But they were in close communication with this guy in London, who was Winston Churchill's personal secretary,
right?
Major Desmond Morton.
Oh yeah.
Morton had been the head of economic warfare in between the wars, and he was a very sort of Crowley-esque character. I'd describe him as very spooky-looking guy. And you'd get, for example, I remember reading in this book, Op JB, which is written by John Ainsworth Davis under a pen name, Christopher Crichton, because he was worried he was going to be arrested under the Official Secrets Act. And he describes how he was called in to see Morton, who was running this thing called M Section of MI6, which was basically an unofficial branch of MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Service, which was funded by the King, King George VI. And he was called in to see Desmond Morton in this office in London, and he was sitting there chatting away with him, and he became aware that, oh, is there someone behind me? He turned around and it was the King.
That's right, yeah. I think we can just pick up there, because on your suggestion, I actually ordered the book from Amazon, Op JB, Operation James Bond, and I managed to squeeze through it in just under 2 weeks. And I guess after I finished the book, it did kind of come across to me as a bit of a fantasy, a bit of a fiction. There might be smatterings of truth in it, but it kind of conflicted with a few other stories. None that I've read completely, because I only had the 2 weeks to finish the books, but I managed to obtain a copy of that. I also managed to get a copy of Paul Manning's book, Nazi in Exile, which I started to read. Obviously didn't get very far. I also had a book called Aftermath by Ladislas Farago. I don't know if you've heard of that book.
Yeah, they're all three very good books, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess for the benefit of people who are going to be listening to this, we describe the theme of Op JB, which is, as you described there, it was obviously a secret mission, codenamed Operation James Bond, but actually included in one of its operatives was Ian Fleming.
Ian Fleming's running it.
Yeah.
He's the commanding officer of the raid.
And the basis of it was to sort of, for want of a better word, rescue Martin Bormann from what would be the clutches of the Russian army who were closing in on Berlin at the time, towards the end of World War II. And it basically takes us through a bit of a timeline and the build-up to the operation, and then takes us through, obviously, the rescue mission and how they got him back to England. And it doesn't go into detail of what they did with the coffers once they got him back to England, whether Britain had distributed it back to
Well, the reason he doesn't is because he wasn't privy to that. That was Morton's part of the
right,
job.
Right, right, okay.
So, I mean, he's talking about what he knew about, which was the actual physical operation of getting to Berlin and getting back.
Yeah, so...
he basically hands over Bormann to Morton, and then that's it. He's off back home.
Yeah, and he describes he sort of resettled him in.
I think the thing is, the other thing to understand about that raid was that the people who were involved in it thought that they were doing the right thing.
Yeah, of course.
It was only in the succeeding years afterwards that they realised that, hang on a minute, what happened to all this money? And why is it that there are reports that Bormann was sort of treated quite well and looked after and helped to get over to South America and managed to then launder a lot of the money from the Second World War, which was then invested into these big network of secret businesses, which had Nazis in charge of them.
Right.
I mean, you know, that I think is the way to see that. I mean, he wouldn't be able to write about that because he didn't know about it. He's able then, but he is able to write about what he does know, which is the actual physical collecting of Bormann from Berlin and how they brought him through the Russian lines and out at the very end of the Second World War.
But he did write about Bormann seeing out the rest of his life in a little hamlet in some backwater village of England, didn't he? Off as somebody's grandfather.
Yes, but then you see, then he goes on and explains that Susan Kemp, who was the woman who took over running the M section MI6 after Morton, had deceived him, you know, so she'd spun him a whole load of lies really about exactly what had happened to Bormann and his burial and this kind of thing. So what they were doing was bringing people in who were thought they were, what they were doing was a kosher military mission, and using them.
Yeah.
And there's a very interesting character that I've discovered since reading that book, who's Harold Wilkinson Golding. He was the commanding officer for British naval forces in World War II for the Royal Navy, and he was in charge of the operation down in near Hayling Island, near Chichester, where John Ainsworth Davis was trained. And others, commandos, were trained. And that whole area was supposed to be at the time top secret. But he would have been asked. He would have been told, or he would have been ordered, possibly. But no, he would have been asked, can we use some of your men for this mission? And he would have said yes, because he was told it was one mission. But actually, after the war, he would have probably found out, oh, it wasn't actually what we thought it was. So they weren't going to bring this money back and Bormann back to London to share the money out. No, they were going to use it for themselves. And once people like Harold Golding, senior naval commander, found this out, it was interesting to see that just about 3-4 weeks after the end of the war, he dropped dead.
Right,
mysterious illness.
Wow, wow.
And his granddaughter is still trying to find out what happened to him. Her name's Jill Golding, and she's been on the BBC down in Southampton, where I used to work, talking about all this. Because she discovered that her grandfather had a DSO, but he'd basically there was an attempt to totally bury him, and from history, even though he was one of the bravest commanders in the Royal Navy of the Second World War, doing more raids on the occupied European coastline than anyone else. So, you know, there are all sorts of other indications that make you think that there's something to this, that there is a real attempt to cover up this particular raid right at the end of the war. And that also, I mean, if you look at the history of Bormann, I mean, it's amazing to see all the other people who Hitler admired and liked slowly disappear.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bormann is left as the only one. I mean, we're talking about Rudolf Hess, for example, in 1941. He was completely spun out from the circle of Hitler in this futile flight to Scotland in a Messerschmitt 110. And Hitler was never to see him again, but someone had convinced him. I think it was partly the Finnish ambassador to Nazi Germany, Tancred Berenius, that persuaded him, but there were various others that persuaded Hess to fly out of the country, and that left Bormann more in charge of Hitler all the time.
Yeah.
Another one was Reinhard Heydrich, who was the butcher of Prague. He was the head of the Gestapo and SS in Prague. And he was supposed to be the guy that Hitler most admired. You know, he was a completely ruthless, evil man. Hitler thought he was great. Suddenly, there was an assassination of him.
Mm.
The special operations executive sent a bunch of Czech soldiers in exile and some others in to kill Heydrich. So all of the people Hitler liked during the war were slowly being sort of bumped off or spun out one by one until only Bormann was really left. And of course, if anyone looks into it, you can see that Hitler had, I don't know how quite to put this politely, but strange, perverse habits sexually. And he had a relationship with his niece, Jelly Raubel, Angela Raubel, in Munich in the early 1930s. And she was growing up. She was only a teenager when he first started this relationship with her. And when she got to, I think it was around about 20 or 21, she decided, look, I don't want nothing to do more with this Hitler guy. And she told him so. She said, look, I've had it with you, Adolf, you know, and I want to get myself a proper boyfriend that isn't into these strange sexual habits. And he shot her dead. So Jelly was shot, and there is very strong evidence of all of this. You can look it all up if you want. And you'll find that the people that helped get off that murder charge were both Martin Bormann, who was in the Nazi Party, and a guy called Heinrich Müller, who was in the Munich police. They both maneuvered to get coroner's verdict of suicide.
Yeah. I kind of remember the story.
From that moment onwards, Hitler is totally beholden to these two because they know all about his dirty past and he's being a murderer. And so, of course, if they're going to control him when it comes to the end game of World War II, they need to make sure, don't they, that anyone else who's friendly with Hitler that he can trust or rely on in his close inner circle is out. What did. And I would even suggest that it may have been Bormann that shot and killed Hitler rather than him committing suicide right at the very end, because I don't imagine they wanted to leave anything to chance.
Okay.
That Hitler might have survived for a few years after the war and been, for example, at the Nuremberg trials, giving evidence about some of his connections with you know, the people that put him into power in the first place, the bankers, etc.
Well, that's interesting because I wanted to touch on that point just at the end, I think. But just before we get on to the potential for Nazism still existing, except under a different moniker, I wonder if we could just take it back to sort of, or just build the foundation of World War One and where we are in 1940. Obviously, Germany's just defeated both the French and the British on European soil. Totally whitewashed the Poles, they've annexed Austria, parts of Czechoslovakia, and I think there's a meeting between Molotov and Hitler, I don't know what month it was, in 1940, where they like to discuss how to divide up Europe, and Molotov comes up with all Stalin's requests for Finland, Romania, I don't know how to pronounce this, but it's the strait between Turkey, is it the Dardanelles?
Yeah.
And Bulgaria, to which I think Hitler sort of rebukes slightly. And apparently the meeting ends on a bit of a sour note, and only sort of bolsters the idea of Directive 21 or Operation Barbarossa. And obviously I think that's the last meeting that they had on sort of platonic terms between the Russians and the Nazis. And obviously it's then that Operation Barbarossa kind of gets, you know, the go-ahead to be planned, and then it's executed in 1941.
Well, there's another really good, important book on this whole stage, because, of course, the timing of Barbarossa was absolutely crucial to who was going to win the war. If Barbarossa in 1941 had been launched on the Eastern Front, that is the Nazi invasion of Russia or attack of the Soviet Union, had been launched a little bit earlier, then it might well have been possible for Stalingrad to have been taken and possibly Moscow to have been taken.
Right.
Before the winter came in. It was a really, really absolutely, and it's many historians overlook it, how important it was, the timing. And I was reading recently William Stevenson's book, which is the first time I picked it up even, which is shameful. It's called a man. The title's A Man Called Intrepid, and it really looks at another William Stevenson, who was one of the key people involved in U.S. British intelligence liaison before the war. Yes, yeah? So that's before the Second World War started. There was definitely Winston Churchill and Roosevelt were very close. They were discussing. We've got to make sure that when this war breaks out, because both of them believed it would, that that the British and Americans are one step ahead of the game. And they even went to the extent in 1939, early 1939, before the war broke out, they'd set up a whole floor of the Rockefeller Center in New York as what they call BSC, which was British Security Coordination, apparently it was called, but it was based in New York, and it had offices in London and various other places, but they were all completely looked like civilians, so there would be nobody would be able to tell that this was what was going on. But one of the things they decided they needed before war broke out was they needed an Enigma machine, and so they actually blew up a truck, a lorry in Poland, which had one of these machines in it. I think it was going from Poland or maybe possibly even into another neighboring country. And they knew the machine was in there. And then what they did is they replaced it with some kind of false twisted metal thing that was made to look like the Enigma that had been in there. And luckily the Nazis didn't realize that they'd actually stolen the Enigma machine before they'd blown the lorry up. And so they managed to get this. I mean, this was absolutely key and crucial when they brought it to London, in beginning the process of making sure they could break all the Nazi codes before the war even started. And the Americans were involved in that. When it came through to 1941, when very few people, I mean, I asked this question to quite a lot of people. I'll ask it to you. Who declared war on who? Was it Nazi Germany on America or America on Nazi Germany?
No, it was Germany on America, wasn't it, after Pearl Harbor?
Absolutely right. A lot of people don't realize that. I mean, I talk to people, they don't realize the Americans could not declare war on Germany because there was a very powerful pro-German lobby, pro-Nazi lobby, and it was called the America First Party, and they were saying, look, this has nothing to do with us, this war in Europe, nothing to do with us at all. It doesn't matter if these people are totally evil. We should just keep out of it all. And so it would be impossible for Roosevelt to get any kind of declaration of war through the democratic process in Congress. And so they had to sit there up in Rockefeller Towers thinking, how the hell are we going to get Hitler to declare war on us? Because that's the only way that we're going to be able to get into the war.
Yeah.
They obviously realized that they were already helping the Brits in many ways through Atlantic convoys and things like that. But this was a serious problem. So what they did is they managed to get hold of a whole bunch of leaks that they knew that the Germans had got, true leaks about British and American cooperation. So the things that the Americans had been doing to help the Brits, even though they weren't officially involved in the war. And that what they do is that they also peppered this list through with some complete fictions about, yeah, we're doing this to help them. We're giving them, secretly giving them all this ammunition. We're secretly giving them all these planes. We're secretly giving them this. And there was a whole list of complete fiction involved in this leak. And what they did is they leaked that list to some agent in South America they knew was working for the Nazis.
Yeah.
It was wired straight back to Hitler. Hitler saw this thing. He saw that, oh, well, we know about that. We know about that. We didn't know about this. And he flew into a rage and declared war on America. So that was the way that the Americans actually tricked Hitler into declaring war on them. I mean, this sort of stuff is not very well known about, but it's an extremely important part. Psychology is an extremely important part, even of now, of modern warfare. If you go to a website, the Saker's website, it's thesaker.is or vineyardsaker.wordpress.com, I think. And he's a former military advisor to the United Nations. He explains that nowadays, even more warfare is psychological. He reckons 80% of warfare is psychological and only 15% is economic, and the final 5% is fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So warfare now is mostly waged through the mainstream press, through the mainstream media. And so the way that actually works nowadays is 90%, about 95% of what you see on the BBC is true, but the crucial 5% are lies.
Mm-hmm.
And these are strategic lies. These are psychological warfare lies. And the target is the general public.
Mm. It is amazing, and obviously you can see it going on all the time with, between North Korea, China, the America, the US, sorry, and Russia at the moment. There's a lot of tension.
I think what you've got is a big kind of US and its allies. There's this fascinating map, the non-integrating gap countries map, where you can see these various countries who are part of this big. I mean, effectively, you've got China on the one hand and all the Chinese allies, and you've got America on the other side, and you've got the Russians in between, and any of these other independent countries are basically being destabilized one by one, or all at the same time. Until they decide, yes, we're going to go in on one side or the other side. And so what's going on really, I suppose, in places like Africa is there's a covert war going on for each ruling group in each country to try and get them to either go over to support the Russians or the Americans.
All right.
And that's what we're looking at now. We're looking at a kind of Illuminati, Masonic-controlled United States and Europe versus a triad-controlled China. Because, I mean, the human rights are appalling in China, of course, as we know. As anyone that actually bothers to look can see. We're now talking about 3 years, I think, is it, in jail for laughing at the national anthem?
Wow.
That's what they're talking about in Hong Kong, which, you know, because they're bringing Hong Kong up in line with the law in the rest of China. So it's a totally, I mean, you had just the other week, you had President Xi saying that he's infallible. And this is now a legal construct. Everything he says has to be true. And if you start contradicting him, you get into trouble. In fact, you might get a knock on the door from the police. You might be arrested. You might have your organs taken out and sold. You know, this is where China is. Okay. So, I'm sure that they're very good at trade and everything, but it's not in any way a free country at all. And in fact, it's going back to the sort of Inquisition days, really. If you think about, you know, the idea of the Pope was infallible, and if anything you say against the Pope, you know, you can victim of the Inquisition. That's what we've got in China now. Mm. So you've got to, I think, see the world in that context to understand what's really going on. Is it two massive power blocks, very much like George Orwell's 1984, vying with each other, actually both very similar, controlled by secret societies. And having incompetent people and pliable people put into key positions in the media, in the banking sector, in political parties, who will just do what they're told, and maybe even being blackmailed. I mean, we've seen recently this whole sort of VIP pedophile scandal here in London. That, to me, is just about blackmail. What you do is you get information on people, you get photographs of them, compromising photographs, and then they find themselves being amazingly shooting up the power to incredible positions of lots of money and lots of power into the cabinet, into government, prime ministers, and like Ted Heath, for example. Yeah. And all of a sudden they're just given bits of paper to sign, and they don't dare do anything but sign them because they know that they could be outed in the Daily Mail the next day.
Mm-hmm. All right, cool. Well, look, I think I know you're short on time, mate. I noticed it's 10 to 10 there, so we'll just quickly get back on track for this for the sort of Nazi in exile theme that we were talking about. So, 1941. I know we've already touched on this. In May 1941, Rudolf Hess flies out to Scotland, thinking that Duke of Hamilton, is it? He thought he could barter a peace deal.
Well, he's been conned. He's convinced that there is a strong enough pro-Nazi faction in Britain. But I mean, of course, there was a strong pro-Nazi faction. In fact, the King Edward VIII was a Nazi. Until he abdicated, there clearly were people who were trying to keep Churchill out of the way. Keep him off the BBC in the late 1930s before he became Prime Minister. And that whole business was, I think, just, you know, simple, very, very pure and simple. Get him out of the way.
Mm.
Because we want Bormann to be the one who's controlling Hitler. We don't want any of his friends around.
Right, right. Okay. I think there was sort of an underlying theme.
I think it's the real reason.
Right,
and also,
right, okay.
If anyone that looks into Hess will see that he was murdered he was killed. He didn't commit suicide. Even his family said when he died, and in fact, funnily enough, just before the Berlin Wall came down, which would have been very inconvenient if he'd managed to live through that, it was just like literally, I think, 6 months or so before the fall of the Berlin Wall, because Hess had been in Spandau jail on his own for decades. And they didn't want him to speak to anyone, hardly to his family. And I think there are things that he knew about the early days of the Nazi Party, the rise of Bormann, and other people who were really running Hitler. I mean, think about Stalingrad, the effect that would have had once you realised anyone with any brains in the Nazi Party and in the Wehrmacht, yes, would have realised that after Stalingrad, they'd lost the war. In fact, Hitler did no more of his big speeches after Stalingrad.
Right.
That point was crucial. And one of the other things, which is in the book by William Stevenson, A Man Called Intrepid, is the way that the Americans were working with the British. In fact, it was Bill Donovan, who appears in the Op JB book as well later on in the war, who went into Yugoslavia just before Barbarossa, because he knew that Hitler had a very, very simple job in occupying Yugoslavia, because most of the top people in Yugoslavia were pro-Nazi.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't going to have much trouble. So Bill Stevenson went into there to warn loads of people, look, they're about to invade. All these people are Nazi collaborators. And several of them were killed. And they had what Stevenson did is he made, when the Nazis did invade Yugoslavia, it was an absolute nightmare for them. So rather than taking a few weeks, it took months. And this is one of the things that delayed the start of Barbarossa, so that Hitler lost the war. so that's just another thing that very few people can see. In fact, even some people in Yugoslavia don't know about that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful nugget of information.
800,000 partisans, if you can imagine that, in Yugoslavia, under Tito, were basically living in the woods, living off slivers of tin, and sabotaging every time the Nazis drove through Yugoslavia. They were scared to death because they knew there was a large chance that they would be ambushed in the woods, somewhere. So Yugoslavia was turned into a very, very, very difficult zone for Hitler. And he had to put loads of divisions into Yugoslavia to occupy it, which he wanted to use against Russia. So it was Bill Donovan's trip there early in 1941 was one of the most important trips of the Second World War that meant that Hitler militarily lost. Although, of course, in many ways, the Nazi Party won because they kept the money. I mean, many of the people involved from that, if you've seen the Paul Manning book, the money was spirited away in bank accounts, mainly in Switzerland. But the guy with the keys to the billions of dollars worth or pounds worth of Deutschmarks worth of gold and other securities that the Nazis had looted was Martin Bormann. Yeah. And he was the man. And there was a confected story. In fact, there are several books out there that try and pretend that Bormann died. This whole episode is incredible that it's still now one of the most important things in history that people are trying to cover up. Vast amounts of money spent on completely fictional books saying Bormann died at the end of the Second World War. Even the Daily Express, I've got a copy of copy of the front page of it here in front of me, actually, funnily enough, from to try and look at the date at the top here somewhere. Anyway, it says, I think it's in the 1970s, world exclusive disclosure, Martin Bormann, Hitler's deputy, alive. And this is actually written by Ladislaus Fraga, by Stuart Stephen as well. They had discovered that he was being kind of covered up for over in South America. And the reason I say that is because, there was Jewish collusion. I should really not say Jewish. I should say Zionist. Because there was a lot of money coming from America, and a lot of the powerful people in America were in on this Nazi loot. So they were taking.
From a sort of political point of view, it would be from an American stance against communism, would it as well? Would that be a fair shout?
Yes. It would have been, yes, definitely. And the money was flowing from these companies. I mean, the thing to understand is Borman created these 750 companies, as Paul Manning describes in his book.
Wow.
Those 750 companies were all over the world, but mainly here in the Western world, in Europe, and then in the United States. And what happened was that the people who were directors of those businesses were mostly ex-SS.
Wow.
Who just basically put on uniform, taken off their uniforms and put on civilian suit and tie and strolled into the boardroom. But the thing that was so devious about what he did is he also put a lot of people as Jewish directors of these companies. The idea being to completely disguise the fact that it was not laundered Nazi money that was behind the business.
Wow.
That was the main, and anyway, and also back in the late 1960s, I think actually mid 1960s, was it about 1962, 63, the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, went over to South America and kidnapped Adolf Eichmann.
Eichmann, yeah.
Who was the guy behind the Final Solution, the Nazi. He was really the last big war criminal to anyone to bother to go after. And well done for Mossad for nabbing him. And they bundled him into a Bristol Britannia in Buenos Aires and flew him over to Tel Aviv. And a year later, he was executed after a standing trial. But what Manning explains is the word went out from on high, no more of this.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. Because some of the networks that were funding Israel were also using this Nazi loot. And so, very clear.
Wow.
Made clear to the Nazis, to the Israelis,
yeah,
the Israeli government, look, any more of this nonsense and we're going to cut off the money to Israel.
Wow.
And so this I think is one of the most fascinating core parts of Paul Manning's book. So you see, you've got two books there. You've got Op JB, which describes the European operation to get Borman out of Berlin.
Yep.
Back to Britain.
And I think just to stress a point there, we need to point out that they also had a body double, a doppelganger that they left behind, didn't they?
That's one of the most gruesome things is this poor guy was found and they said, oh, you look like this guy. We want you to go on the mission. Yep. But no one told him why.
Yep.
The reason was he even had dental surgery.
That's
so
right.
That his teeth, Borman's.
Yep.
And at the last minute, the idea was to blow this poor guy up and leave it as Borman's body. Now, that's not a very nice thing to do to somebody. And what John Ainsworth Davis describes is that he was just killed by a shell fired from a tank.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
a Russian
tank. Yeah,
it might just be that they didn't really want to say yes, we killed him. You know, but that's if anyone ever says to you, you look like someone else, will you come on this mission?
I think don't do it.
Very, very, very aware that they might be just killed and their body used as a substitute for that person. Anyway, so that you're absolutely right. That was part of the operation. I think the other thing to understand is how important it was that Ian Fleming was involved in all of this. Because as the guy that wrote the Bond novels, he was very, very much in the know. He was working for Naval Intelligence. He was actually in charge of this mission. And the reason why he was, I think, after the war, he hit the bottle. If you read his biography, you'll find that Fleming just started drinking. There's another guy that did as well, Boy Browning, who was the commander at Arnhem, hit the bottle. But, I mean, they were for different reasons, really. Browning, because he had been such a total coward and an idiot and completely lost. He was in charge of the mission that was supposed to end the war by Christmas 1944, and he just started tooling around that whole part of the world in his little Jeep, getting photographs for the British newspapers and having nice slap-up meals. And he wasn't actually – he was supposed to be the general in charge of the operation – and it all went horribly wrong. He also blamed the Poles, which was a hideous thing to do because it was his fault, not the Poles' fault, that it had gone wrong. Anyway, so that's a bit of a distraction. But Arnhem is very important in that it was the same location as the British were smashed to pieces at Arnhem, where they held the first Bilderberg conferences in 1954, 10 years after the battle there. And that, I think, was just an in-joke. It's like saying, look, here's the bit where we knew exactly what the British were up to, and we managed to stop them doing what ending the war, and we got ourselves enough time to get all the loot out from Berlin and around the world, which was the reason, I think, why Market Garden was sabotaged from inside and idiots were put in charge of it. And some people would say Lord Carrington was very much involved in stopping the armour on the ground, the tanks, actually going to Arnhem. I mean, they were all ready to go, and Carrington sat there in his tank, and he just wouldn't go to rescue the 1st Airborne Division at Arnhem. It was only about 20 minutes' drive away, but he said, no, I'm sitting here, and my orders are to stay here. But the Americans were going, look, what the hell are you doing? We've just taken this bridge. Get down that road now, and they wouldn't go. So the Arnhem story is important. Then another thing which is really important is a little bit before that, in August 1944, is the Red House meeting where Bormann met with all the German industrialists to set in train the process for surviving the war, effectively a Fourth Reich, a financial Fourth Reich, using banks instead of tanks.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, I think, is the take-home from all of this, is you've got – The two most important books really being the Paul Manning book, and he was working for CBS broadcasting in America during the Second World War, telling everyone in the States what was happening day by day on the Western Front. And then he gets to write this final book before he died, which was his swan song, really. It was a culmination of all of the things that he'd seen in the war. And as journalists, we are the only person that can see this thing. We have a very privileged position, and Manning was in that position to see that there was a much bigger game going on, and that actually the Allies, as soon as the war had finished, were immediately cooperating with the Nazis. They wanted to use them to fight the Russians with the expertise of the people like Reinhard Gehlen, who was the Nazi intelligence commander on the Eastern Front. He was immediately brought in to take over in the new West German army. A whole loads of Nazis co-opted into the American forces and secret
Operation
services.
Paperclip, a great example.
Effectively, it was just a deal, money for safe passage. Let's look at what is fascism. What was Hitler's so-called ideology really all about? It was just about it's about confecting a way for rich people to hang on to their money. The cartel system where the public are fleeced, there's no real competition, and making sure there's a tiny group of oligarchs that are running society and that they can hang on to their power. And if it looks like democracy is starting to surface, whether it's in terms of Marxism or socialism or any kind of real democracy, the fascists want to be able to stick the boot in and just take over. But they want to have some kind of ideology behind them. The other thing to understand about fascism is that it's not just about nationalism at all. There's a fascist international. Look at Bilderberg, for example. A very internationalist, globalist organization.
Well, I wanted to touch on that little topic with you. I know we're going to sort of run out of time in a minute, so I just want to kind of summarize it before we finish. Keeping on track with the sort of 750 companies. Obviously you're in the know about this. I didn't research this far. I researched up to obviously Bormann being whisked out of war-torn Berlin. But I guess, if we were to touch on how we haven't defeated Nazism, are we talking that the Bilderberg group that you've done quite a lot of research on, and also it has its roots in Nazism, and also what would you say the leading companies around the globe that have also got the roots National Socialism?
Well, look, it's very difficult to pin down specific companies, but you can see companies like BMW,
right?
Companies like Siemens. These were Nazified companies. Volkswagen. Yeah. I mean, these big businesses. I mean, actually the Quant family, who are behind BMW, is a privately owned business. They made all their money from batteries for tanks and submarines in the Second World War. At the end of the war, they sold that business and bought BMW. And the way that BMW is, for example, taken over from British industry is exactly the Nazi plan for Europe. This is where the EU comes into all of this,
European
Union and the common market, because there was a Nazi plan for occupied Europe, for the economy, to turn it into cartels where the Germans were running everything. And that's effectively what's happened in all the big industries, in iron and steel. They're now talking about Thyssen taking over, ThyssenKrupp they call it, taking over the Port Talbot Steelworks in South Wales. Well, Thyssen was the original funder of the Nazi Party
right.
in the early 1930s. And I think this is where we are now, is you've got all the big heavy industry is controlled and run from Germany, and many of the people here are very good people who are working in it. But what they don't understand is that this is a kind of industrial tyranny, where you have one place which is commanding everything. I mean, even the new stations that have been built, some of them in this country, railway stations, it's all built with German steel, German expertise. Don't tell me we can't do these things, and don't tell me that there's any kind of fair competition. There isn't. The cartel system works as follows. You get a bunch of companies that are part of the cartel. Whoever wins a big contract shares the work amongst the cartel.
Yep.
And then they all fix the prices, so that they're all going to make an absolute fortune out of it, and particularly out of public contracts. This is how fascism has been so successful over the last 20 years or so over in Spain, where we've seen with Catalonia and King Felipe and Rajoy, is that all the big public contracts in Spain have been kickbacks that have been going into a Swiss bank account from those contracts, which have led to tens of millions of euros sitting there to go to any government minister. So this is what there's a corruption scandal, the Gürtel scandal, going on in Spain at the moment, where all the good judges have been kicked out. So there won't be any proper prosecutions of the ruling fascist party. I mean, I think you can call the People's Party a fascist party. It's Franco's party, Rajoy's party, Felipe's party. And, you know, this is why they're doing what they're doing to Catalonia, is because they are in control. They're not interested in listening to the people. They might use the press to try and pretend they are, but, you know, they're just not going to accept people doing what they want. And that's, I think, the same sort of thing as we saw in the Nazi plans for occupied Europe. So in a way, the common market and the European Union were the culmination of the Nazis' plans that they developed during the Second World War. That's why I think it's fair to say that there has been this kind of Fourth Reich. Also, very clear to see the way that companies and businesses and countries are being taken over. It's by using a fraudulent banking system. HSBC, these big banks, are just purchasing. They're not demolishing with tanks and shells, they're just purchasing.
Yep.
Now we hope get out.
So
you've got a financial warfare that's been going on, and in fact you can trace a lot of this stuff back to, as I said right at the start, Major Desmond Morton, who was the King's own personal psychological warfare officer, this Crowley-esque figure in the interwar years doing psychological warfare, and then turning into this guy who's running this kind of private King's private MI6 raid service at the end of the war. And that, I think, is the way to understand these. There's little tiny amounts. I mean, for example, the Bilderbergs you mentioned, quite clear and obvious. The Bilderbergs rewarded people that helped the Nazis in Operation Market Garden in Arnhem by giving them jobs at Bilderberg. Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. He was the liaison officer and the Dutch liaison officer that betrayed the plans of Arnhem through a guy called King Kong, Christian Lindemans, his agent, so-called agent, that went to talk to the Dutch underground a few days before Arnhem. Actually didn't go and talk to the Dutch underground. He went straight to the Abwehr, which is the German army intelligence, and gave them the plans. So Bernhard was rewarded afterwards being the chairman of the Bilderberg conferences for 20 years until he was kicked out after a bribe of $1 million from Lockheed was discovered by a chambermaid in a hotel and published in Holland. And yeah, so then he was kicked out. But then Carrington took over, who was another one involved in Operation Market Garden, sitting in his Grenadier Guards tank and refusing to go and help the dying Brits at the bridge at Arnhem. So I think that there is a sort of continuity here between people who there's evidence, an evidence trail, I think is probably the best way to put it, where you can see crooked people through the decades have been massively rewarded, and that the Second World War, I mean, you could even go back and look as far as the letter in the 1800s from Albert Pike, which talks about various world
Freemason, 33 degree,
yeah, and a plan for these various world wars to cause such cataclysm.
Well,
that people around the world clamour for a one world government, for a globalist setup. Now imagine what that would be like.
The Illuminati, that goes right to the root of conspiracy theories, doesn't it, I guess?
The Illuminati, yeah, the Illuminati definitely factual historically. It was a big scandal late 1700s. I mentioned them before. They emerged about the same time as the Triads in China. So you do wonder if there was a big plan being sort of foisted out at that point, you know. And I think also to understand that who is it that ends up in these positions of power? It's generally people who are quite insecure, who feel that they've got to, in order to make their lives worthwhile, they've got to get some sort of massive amount of power. And that, I think, is quite sad, really, that people feel they've got to do that in order to make their lives worth living. And if they find that, of course, that power is tainted, all they can do is make things worse. All they can do is kill, you know, start wars nowadays anyway, you know, and there's very little room for anyone that's actually trying to make the world a better place in those highest positions. Apart from, I would suggest, the Kremlin seem to be playing a very, very moral role in doing what the United Nations is failing to do, in other words, to basically put a great big brick wall in front of the war on terrorism that the Americans and the Israelis and the Brits have so fraudulently got behind.
Yeah.
These bomb attacks that happen in domestic countries that are then blamed on fuzzy wuzzies, where actually they're plotted and planned by our own intelligence services who are completely unaccountable and making loads of money out of this little game. And, I mean, where does this end? This is the question, isn't it? I mean, I think we're going to end up with some sort of police state. It's already been put in place.
Yeah, 1984, mate, isn't it? It's all coming true,
this kind of world. And I just think we need to be, first of all, aware that this is going on in order to take some action. But, of course, the mainstream press is just simply not going to tell us about this, at least for the time being.
Yeah, and reading a big, thick book is too much hard work for most people. Listen, Tony, I know we've got 2 minutes until you're allowed.
Hopefully listening to podcasts like yours is a bit easier than reading that big, thick book.
Well, I've got to read it, haven't I? And then I can talk about it. Listen, absolute pleasure talking to you. You're a fountain of knowledge. It's been a real eye-opener. There's loads of things that we didn't touch on. I wanted to talk about the recently opened CIA files on Hitler in South America. We can maybe organise another one of these at some point if you've got time. But I just wanted to say a massive thanks. And obviously I'll edit the start out and I'll get it uploaded onto iTunes and I'll copy you in and send you a link on Twitter. Is there anything you want to give a plug to just while we round it up?
Well, I mean, but my various websites, I suppose I should try to, and the radio program in Bristol. Every week I do a live program for 2 hours, which you'll find at thisweek.org.uk. Or if you're in Bristol, you can pick it up on 93.2 between 5 and 7 every Friday. I do another program, which is at, oh, by the way, that Daily Express, Saturday, November the 25th, 1972.
Wow. That's my birthday.
Okay, so that's just the date of that Daily Express. So, it's another program called Dialect, which we do on, which goes out on a Tuesday lunchtime, which is a bit lighter, usually. And then there's also the thing called the 9/11 Forum I do, 9/11forum.org.uk, where various of us that have been part of the UK 9/11 Truth Group, we're on there pretty regularly. And also, the website Bilderberg.org, and I've just heard, I don't know if hardly anyone else has broadcast this, but you can, that the next year's Bilderberg conference, that is to say the 2018 Bilderberg conference, is going to be, it looks like, in Venice, in Italy, on a little island, just off Venice, actually. So that's going to be, I think it's something like the 6th to the 9th of June next year. So it looks like that's when it's going to be. We're not 100% sure, but there's a massive block booking that they don't want to talk about at this massive Marriott hotel in Venice.
Exclusive.
It's on the little island. So that's probably where the Bilderbergers are going to be. The bigger question in some ways though is the Pinay Cercle. It's Le Cercle. And these are basically the Fascist International, and they're a committee. I mean, I don't know, Masonic or not, I don't think it really matters. These are the guys who are the super far right, and it's amazing to me that nobody from the left really seems to even know about them. But they are a sort of command structure of a lot of them are ex-intelligence, a lot of them are far right MPs, and they are a kind of fascist organising committee. And it would be nice to know when they are, because Bilderberg really is more of a place where people are interviewed to become prime ministers and things like that. It's right. not actually making the big decisions, which I think are made at places like Le Cercle.
Okay. Well, I'll have to look that one up myself. I've never even heard of it, to be honest. But excellent. Right, well, Tony, it's been an absolute pleasure. And
I mean, for me, the Bilderberg was opened a lot of these doors, really, and discovering that there is, as someone had worked as a journalist in mainstream media, to suddenly discover that there's this group that no one wants to talk about that seems to have the richest and most powerful people in the Western world all meeting in secret, you know, that was a red rag to a bull to me. And it's been an interesting journey, you know, discovering about how the way power really works. And it's opened a whole kind of different view on history for me.
Yeah.
And hopefully for others.
Sorry, mate, go on, finish off on that one.
And hopefully for others too.
Yeah.
You know, that this is a thing, you know, to understand how history has been messed around with. And this is exactly what George Orwell said, isn't it? He who controls the past controls the present. He who controls the present controls the future.
Yeah.
I think it's something like that anyway.
It is, yeah.
But
that's exactly
the whole point. The whole point really being that we can't really understand where we're going or where we are. And the people that have controlled the view of history we get at schools and all this kind of thing are completely controlling our perceptions of the way things are now. And the mainstream press is really not helping.
Exactly. Okay. Twitter handle, is it just at Tony Gosling, all one word?
That's it. Yeah, that's it.
Awesome. Right, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'll let you get off. We're 3 minutes over time there, mate. You're going to be late for wherever you need to be.
Alex, thanks very much for asking me on, and maybe we'll do it again sometime and go down some other rabbit hole.
Absolutely. Love to, mate. Be a pleasure.